Ramos, Democrat Richardson, she agreed with the calls for Slayton to step down. The young adults working in the Capitol are vulnerable, and predators readily target these young people. We owe it to these young professionals to set the standard and protect them from harm, she said in a tweet. For the rest of the story, please go to texastribune.org. This is Steve Gallington of the People's News, which can be heard on Sundays at noon, Mondays at 9 a.m., and Thursdays at 9 a.m. on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community radio.
Howdy, folks. This is Big Kev, your most excellent host of the Roots Rock Revolution. And you lucky folks, you're listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM HD1. Check us out. You'll love it.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Heen, backed up by the most talented team on radio, and here on So What's Your Story, we feature storytellers every week who will take us on magical journeys before landing us safely back into the present. Well, our first guest today is Barbara Legere. Barbara is the author of Kevin's Choice, A Mother's Journey Through Her Son's Mental Illness, Addiction, and Suicide. After losing her son, Kevin, to suicide, Barbara's passion has been reaching out to other grievers to offer support and understanding. She does this through her writing and as a volunteer for the TIP, which is the Traumatic Intervention Program. Barbara, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I've been reading your book, Kevin's Choice, and it's one of the most brutally honest books that I've ever read. And it's such a powerful story that right now I just want to kind of sit back and give you the stage and share your story of Kevin.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for saying that. The only way I know how to write is to be brutally honest. And I'll say it was intimidating writing some of the things I shared in that book, but I just wanted to give a really accurate and honest view of what life is like for someone who is addicted to drugs and has a mental health issue going on. And that was mainly the focus of the book. I'm a single mom, and Kevin was my only child. So when I lost him, my life just changed in that moment. And I didn't know what to do with myself. The first year was just, it was horrific. I couldn't function very well, and I felt sick all the time. It was awful. But I started getting this nagging voice in my head saying, you need to write a book about this. And I felt like it was Kevin urging me to do it, because he and I had talked so many times about writing a book together, hopefully about how he overcame. But instead, I found myself writing about him and his life and the struggles that he had and what it's like for a parent to go through that with their child.
Right.
I belong to several support groups that are full of parents who have either lost their child to drugs or are still watching their child going through that process. And it's a grieving process to watch someone who is so deep into addiction that their life really isn't the same life. They aren't the same person. And that's where my grief really started. I feel like I lost him years before he actually died. So in writing the book, it did help my grief process, but mostly I just wanted to share with people what it's like so that they would have more compassion and so that they would understand that rehab isn't always the answer. It doesn't work for everyone. Mental health care is an illusion that it's available to everyone, because unfortunately, the deep kind of care that you need, the inpatient care, is not something that's not out there. It's not available. It's not affordable. So that was kind of my main reasoning for writing the book.
So is it kind of a catharsis for you to open up about this and reach out to other people? Is it kind of part of the healing process?
Absolutely. For me, everybody has a different way of dealing with grief, but for me, it's making a difference by trying to help other people. And I recently, at the beginning of this year, I went through an intensive training to be a part of a program called TIP. You mentioned Trauma Intervention Program. And what they do is we respond to calls from first responders when there is some kind of a crisis, usually a death. Mm-hmm. And it's a volunteer position, and we show up at that scene and we comfort the person who has had the loss. Mm-hmm. And they sent someone to my home when I lost Kevin, and it made all the difference to me that day. It was like I could just sit and grieve and be hysterical or cry or whatever. And I knew that this woman was there to answer the questions, to be a liaison with the police, and mostly just to acknowledge my grief.
And now you're a part of them.
Yeah, so now I'm a part of them. And been very rewarding.
In your book, Barbara, you talk a lot about how involved you became with the drug culture itself, with Kevin's friends. You were privy to drug deals going on and so forth. Give us some background on that.
Wow. Yeah, that was a really hard part to write, because that's the part I would rather just ignore. But it's how I learned so much. All of his friends would say, wow, your mom really gets it. And that's because I spent time with them. I was the mom that would pick somebody up late in the middle of the night if they were in a bad situation. I cared about his friends. I could see that they were wonderful people, just like Kevin was, that got stuck in a really bad situation. And yes, I found myself going into drug houses. Well, the main one I went into was to retrieve something that belonged to me, but it was very scary and intimidating. And to see what I saw, I mean, I'd heard about drug houses, but to actually be standing in one and seeing people just lying around, either passed out or shooting up, and it was really upsetting. But it showed me what it's like in that situation for these guys and gals. And a lot of them want help, and they just feel hopeless. They feel like they can't do it. And that's what's so heartbreaking.
Yeah, so it's like you had a front row seat to the drug culture there.
Yeah, I did. I got to know a lot of his friends. I got to see a lot of things. And I also, most of the people, in fact, all of his friends that I was close to, with the exception of one, are now gone as well. They all passed away.
From overdose, largely?
Overdose, yes. All of them from overdose.
I remember there were some success stories I read there.
Yes, there are. There's always success stories. And I don't want anyone to listen to this and think there's not hope, because there are tons of success stories. And when a person is ready and willing to do what it takes for them individually to change and get help, they can do it. I mean, there's so many stories of success. I mean, there's great books out there too that I've read from addicts who have overcome and now they're thriving in their life and just, you know.
So there is hope.
Oh yeah, there is a ton of hope. Yeah, there is.
So can you sort of take us through the story of how it all began, the first signs of it, and how you reacted, and
sure,
take it from there?
Yeah, Kevin, he was depressed as a child. So he struggled with depression, as I did, from an early age. And then when he was 15, like most teenagers, he experimented with weed and drinking. And, you know, that didn't concern me too much because it was kind of like what everybody did. I did it and I was fine. But then when he was 17, he met some people that were older than him that he started hanging out with. They were very nice. I liked them. They went to college. They had jobs. They were great. But I didn't know they were all doing heroin. And one time when they were with Kevin, there was three of them. Two of them said, "Don't try it, Kevin. It'll ruin your life." But the third one said, "Oh, come on, try it." And he listened to her, and it did. It ruined his life. Man. It ruined his life completely. And he actually, I didn't even know for 3 whole months he was using. I didn't recognize the signs because unless you see someone immediately after they use, you don't really realize it. I mean, these three kids were using, they were at my house high, but I couldn't tell because it seemed fine. It's when you see them nodding out or you're with them when they're right after they use that you really notice. And then there's other signs too, like hygiene goes downhill.
Right.
They spend more and more time alone, all of those type of things, stealing, lying. But he actually came to me and told me one night that he had been using and he wanted to stop. So that was how I found out about it. He told me himself.
So you were made aware of it. He came to you. You didn't discover it. He came to you.
Yes, he did. Yeah. As I said, we were very close. He told me everything. Sometimes things I didn't even want to know.
Yes.
And you know, we sought help. He was at least 13 rehabs that I know of. And in the beginning, as a parent, I was completely naive. I didn't know anything about it. I thought you go to rehab, you get better, and then you move on. I didn't know that you had to go to several usually, and that you may never move on. So that was eye-opening. And that's when I decided I need to educate myself because I wanted to understand exactly what he was going through. I think a lot of parents have expectations that their child should just stop using and get their life together. But if you really understand physiologically, mentally, what's going on inside the person, it gives you more compassion and understanding. I couldn't kick him out on the street. I mean, I tried that because I was told by everyone, you know, tough love is the answer. And that was not the answer for us at all. And a lot of people are realizing that tough love is not the most helpful thing to do. For some people it works, but not for everyone.
Yeah, I noticed in your book you talked about how you'd question yourself about, am I enabling this? Am I doing the right thing? Am I too nice to him? But it seems to me that, you know, the carrot and the stick approach, you were doing it with open arms, with love. And despite what the hardliners say, it seems like you probably shouldn't have any regrets.
Yeah, I don't have any regrets. And I do feel like I have to defend myself a lot by some of the things I do, but it's an individual thing. And I knew that Kevin needed to know that he was loved and accepted and worthy. And by if I pushed him away, I think I would have lost him a lot sooner. I really do.
Yes, you had a very, very unique relationship, I could see from reading the book. And also, it expanded beyond Kevin into his network of friends. You became very close to his drug-addicted friends. Tell us a little bit about that. How do those relationships went?
Well, one in particular, Anthony, I think I wrote a whole chapter on Anthony. He became like my second son. He was the classic person that you would think would become an addict because he was raised by addicts and criminals. And he lost his mother to drugs and he lost his father to prison. So he was pretty much alone in the world when I met him. And we fell in love with each other. I just could see his heart. You know, this was a good person. This was a kid who was abused and had a horrific life. But not only him, but, you know, there was several other people that I just really could see inside their heart to who they were. And I knew that they didn't want this for themselves. They hated their lives. They hated what they were doing to their families, making their parents worry and losing friends, losing their job, losing everything, really. And I just wanted to be that person there that said, hey, you know, you are loved and you are valuable. And that's kind of how I became close to most of them.
Right. So you seem to be very talented, usually smart people. Stereotypical, you know, drug addicted personality that is out there.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. I mean, I think by now most people know that someone with substance abuse disorder is coming from any type of family. It does not matter what your family life is like. Like I said, Anthony is someone you would expect it from, but all these other kids, I call them kids, even though they were adults, they had loving parents, raised in a wonderful family, went to school, had everything they needed. And it just doesn't matter. It could happen to any family.
So it seems like you've gone beyond just the personal experience. You've sort of expanded publicly in research of drug issues and so forth. So I guess we could say you're an expert.
Yeah, an unwilling and wanting to be expert.
But I think
because it's not something I want to be an expert in, but I'm glad that I did learn all I did. I really am.
Of course. And you're in such a unique position because you were right there, right in the middle of the culture all this time.
There's a lot of parents just like me out there. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, too, is because they've read it and given it to a friend or a family member that didn't understand why they were still, you know, allowing their child to live in their home or whatever. And they thanked me and they said, well, my friend finally gets it because now they can see, you know, what it was like for me. So yeah, there's tons of us out there. I just wrote about it. So I'm just one of many.
Well, I recommend the book highly. It's intriguing and it's hard to read in places. It's, you know, gets you right there, but it's an important subject. So now, why did you call the book Kevin's Choice? Why did you choose that title?
I chose that title. My first title was Dying to Be Free, but it was already taken. So I called it Kevin's Choice because ultimately it was his choice to end his life. And a lot of people, there's a lot of stigma surrounding suicide. A lot of people think it's selfish and they don't understand how someone could do that to their family. Well, he didn't do it to me. He did it to himself and he knew I would be devastated. But we had talked about it, as I said in the book, so many times for so many years. I really believe he waited till my mother was gone. She had passed away because he knew she would not be able to take it. It was his choice to move beyond the pain and the desperation that he felt on a daily basis and just to move on to whatever happens next. I do believe there's an afterlife and I do believe he's there and I connect with him. I feel like he's with me all day long.
Yes. And you're helping to keep him alive through you're sharing his story to everybody. Now, Barbara, it seems like America's been on with this war on drugs for decades now. I mean, I remember Nancy Reagan saying, just say no, you know, it's decades go by and we're still in this war on drugs. In your opinion, is it things getting better or worse or changing? How are things going?
They're not getting better, that's for sure. In fact, right now, because of fentanyl, I think things are at an all-time worse than they've ever been. Because, for example, heroin users, heroin is not really out there as much. Everybody has switched over to fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And fentanyl is deadly. Now, for example, Kevin switched to fentanyl. He knew what he was doing. It was cheaper. The high was longer. Everything about it was better, except if you took a little too much, you would die. Mm-hmm. A lot of people die that way. But the real scary thing about it is that they're lacing it in pills that young kids, teenagers, are thinking they're taking a Xanax or something to keep them up while they're studying for a test. Oh. And it kills them. You know, this is the big problem. There are so many parents out there that are angry, and they're making a lot more noise than was made when people were just dying of a regular overdose, so to speak.
So are we headed in the right direction here with fentanyl?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think, yes, because it's been publicized more, people are talking about it more. The shame isn't in it as much because a lot of parents feel that their children are victims. Mm-hmm. And so they don't mind talking about it when there was a lot of shame involved for parents for years in admitting their child was addicted to opiates. So mm-hmm. I do see that as a positive. And I belong to several sites where people list every day when they've lost someone. I have seen a slight decrease in that. Mm-hmm. We check on those stats every day, but it's still a major problem. Mm-hmm. I wish I knew what the answer was, but yeah. You know, there's a lot of theories. There's a lot of theories on what the answer is.
Sure. Well, you're doing your part.
Thank you.
There's prevention and there's treatment and there's so many different angles to it.
Oh, yeah. Prevention, I think, is so important. Just having mental health and checking out, you know, why, you know, just teaching your children from such a young age. I mean, we can't be afraid to bring it up when they're in elementary school, even. Mm-hmm. Like fifth and sixth grade, and then increase that education as they get older to the point where they are scared. They mm-hmm. do not want to risk ruining their life or losing their life, because that's really what happens.
It's almost like there can't be too much education on it.
No, I don't think there can.
Because from reading the book, Kevin, he was a really talented guy. If we could talk about him a little bit. The skeet shooting, he was
yes.
perfect scores in skeet shooting. I mean, I've done that before. I know that's not an easy task.
No, I've done it too. I've never got that, not even close to that. And he was so young when that happened. It was one of those moments I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was raised around shooting. My dad shot. And so it kind of came naturally. Kevin got interested in it as well. And he was just off the charts intelligent. I mean, he was so smart. He didn't get good grades in school, but he was very smart. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. He was a very loving person. Mm-hmm. He was very generous, funny. Everyone loved Kevin. If they met him, they loved him. And same with Anthony. Anthony was extremely talented artist and musician and songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they both had so many good attributes. One thing a lot of people that struggle with substance use disorder have in common is that they are those creative, sensitive type of person.
Oh, yeah. So many artists and musicians.
Yeah. It reminds me of that line in Don McLean's song about Vincent van Gogh that said, "Vincent, this world wasn't made for someone as beautiful as you."
Mm-hmm. Starry, starry nights.
Yeah. I love that song.
Now, Barbara, you wrote another book, kind of a follow-up to this one, apparently. And it is called, I'm sorry, what is it? The other book?
It's called Talk to Me, I'm Grieving, Supportive Ways to Help Someone Through Grief. And I wrote that one. It's more of a you know, how to help book. because I realized after losing Anthony, actually, how uncomfortable people are around talking about death.
Yes.
And then losing Kevin to suicide was even more so. I mean, people disappeared out of my life. People didn't want to talk to me about it. They thought it would upset me to talk about it, so they avoided it. Sure. And then I feel like they don't care. So I thought I would write a book that would help people understand why the common cliches that we use are often more harmful than helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know what to say, and it's no one's fault. People usually want to say something helpful, but they're used to society, you know.
I've been in that situation not long ago, Barbara. One of my best childhood friends, his daughter died from an overdose.
Oh, gosh.
And the first time I saw him, I felt like a blithering idiot because it seemed like anything I could think of saying just fell short, just wasn't good enough. So maybe I should get your book.
You should. It's not quite out yet. It will be out on the 3-year anniversary of losing Kevin, which is August 11th. It is available for pre-order now, but I really think it will help people. And I write about very specific types of loss, not just overdose and suicide, but losing a spouse, losing someone that is still alive, but has had a health issue that has taken them pretty much away, losing someone to murder.
Wow.
Yeah, I know two people who have lost someone to murder. And one is probably one of the most famous murders we've ever had. But yeah, I tried to find people that had different kinds of loss to share what they felt like. And then I try to explain, you know, what can we say or do that really makes a difference? And what should we avoid saying? So I really hope it makes, you know, it helps people.
Yeah.
Because someone that's grieving feels so alone. I mean, it's a very lonely place to be. Mm-hmm. My number one suggestion is to find a support group.
Yeah.
And if you can find one for your specific type of grief, all the better.
Mm-hmm. Right. Support groups are great.
Yeah.
For some reason, for me, it's easier if it's like an elderly grandmother passing away who's had a good long life. But when it's somebody with their whole life ahead of them, something like that happens, I just don't know what to say. So there really is
nothing you can say to make the person feel better. I think what matters most is that you let them know that they are suffering the greatest loss imaginable, and you are there for them, that you want to hear them talk about whoever it is, the
right.
young person, that you want to hear them talk about it, that you'll just sit with them if they feel lonely. You don't even have to talk. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can support someone without knowing exactly what to say, because there really are no words.
Mm-hmm. Now, Barbara, I want to say I really appreciate, I know it isn't easy talking about these things, so I really appreciate you sharing your story with us today. And you have a website that people can go to find out more about what you do. Could you tell us about that website?
Sure. It's at myfirstandlastname.com, Barbara Legere, LEGERE. And on there, I have my books. I have a blog that I write sometimes once or twice a month. It just depends. I have links to my podcast, and I have resources for help with addiction and suicide and some other things and mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a good site. I recommend it highly. I like
Thank
how you put those resources in. Yeah, it seems like there are always new organizations coming up and this and that, and you seem
yeah.
to keep up to date with that pretty good.
I try.
Thanks again, Barbara, for being on So What's Your Story. And do you have any final words of inspiration for our listeners you'd like to leave us with?
Let's see. Yes, I would just like to remind everyone that there is hope for someone who's struggling with substance use or mental health. There is help available. You really have to be tenacious about it sometimes to find the right help, but to never give up hope. And also to have compassion towards those who are struggling. It's not their fault. It really is not their fault. If they could help it, they would. And as far as if you know someone who's grieving, they just want your support. They want you to listen. And that, like, for example, my favorite thing to do is talk about Kevin. So any of my friends that ask me, hey, tell me Kevin's story, or just bring him up or bring up a memory, that is the best thing ever. Mm-hmm. So just keep that in mind if you know someone who's grieving. Okay. And thank you so much, Eric. I really enjoyed talking to you. You're a great guy, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Barbara. Hey, you keep up the good work. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we're going to take a break from our stories now for station identification and to make a few announcements. You're listening to So What's Your Story? Here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Our show is sponsored by the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild features various storytelling events, including monthly story swaps the fourth Tuesday of every month. And everybody is welcome to tune into these swaps. So to find out more about the Houston Storytellers Guild, go to HoustonStorytellers.org. And while you're there, check out our program on that same website. Just go to the So What's Your Story tab, and you'll find archives from our show dating all the way back to the year 2008. You can listen to us live every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., or you can also live stream us on kpft.org at that same time. We're also on Facebook, so just go to So What's Your Story on Facebook and check us out there. And don't forget our friends at the Moth Storytelling Organization. The Moth features monthly story slams the second Tuesday of every month down at the Warehouse Live on Emanuel Street. Their next swap will be May 9th, and the theme for the stories that night will be gossip. So if you have any good gossipy stories, come to the Moth at Warehouse Live next May 9th at 7 p.m. Now we're going to hear from Ankit Shukla. Ankit was born in India, but grew up in Sparks, Nevada. After getting a nursing degree, Ankit set out to become a traveling nurse in 2010, which he still does to this day. Ankit is also pursuing careers in motivational speaking, writing, and life coaching. Ankit has written several books, including one coming out called Going Global, The Life of a Traveling Nurse. Ankit, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Hey, thank you, Eric, for having me. I appreciate it. And yeah, it's good work there. Yeah, I've been, like, the last couple years, I've really been focusing on my writing career. So yeah. I still do nursing full time. And then my writing career has really been a major focus of mine. And like you said, I grew up in Sparks, Nevada, got my nursing degree. Ever since I was a kid, I always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I just didn't really know how to pursue it. There are various times throughout the years where I tried to write, but I just couldn't. I don't know if the topic just wasn't right, or if I wasn't motivated, or I just didn't think I could do it. But then I got to a point in my life, in my late 20s, where I said, you know, I think I can finally do this. I have, like, a lot of life experience. I learned a lot from other people. So I wrote my motivational book, the Don't Live the Good Life, Live the Better Life, because I just felt I had a wealth of information to give people that I think people could use on their everyday lives to live better.
Yeah. I'm just going to say, now you have this book coming out, or is it out already, called Going Global, The Life of a Traveling Nurse. Could you tell us a little bit about what you've been going through with that kind of work? What are you conveying through this book to your readers?
Sure, absolutely. So I wanted them to get an idea of what it's like to be a traveling nurse, at least through my eyes. Kind of, I take them through my process of first becoming a nurse, deciding to become a traveling nurse, and then, like I said, some of my life experiences as a traveling nurse, so people can get an idea of what it's truly like to be in that field, and the good and the bad, mostly good, I would say. But, you know, people can, you know, kind of walk with me through my shoes and walk down memory lane as I'm talking about some of the things I experienced.
Well, let's hear some of it. What have you experienced?
Going from different state to different state. The thing about a traveling nurse is you have to be able to adapt very quickly. there's you pretty much have to know what you're doing. It's just kind of getting used to the actual facility or area you're working in. And you could be working in, you know, New York City 1 week, and then next week, the following week, you're traveling to your new assignment in Hawaii or wherever, yeah. Which is, you know, huge culture dynamics. So you have to be able to fit in very quickly with a wide variety of people. And as you know, you go to different parts of the country, small towns versus big cities, you know, liberal versus conservative areas and sure. all that. I've worked and everything in between. I've worked in all of those places. Mm-hmm. And I will say, in my personal experience, I've always gotten along with people, and I feel that most people are good people, you know, regardless of their background. And we just, mm-hmm. and if we all took the time to actually get to know each other and talk, I think we would all find out that we have a lot more in common than whoever the powers that be led on. The cool thing about it is, like, hey, I took care of people in Atlanta and New Jersey and Texas, and you know, there are people that I met that I wouldn't have never gotten a chance to meet if I.
Yeah, can you give us like some of your experiences? What any stories about your work?
You know, you have a lot of experiences. Like, you know, dialysis is a life-saving procedure. Without it, you know, if people went a few days without it, I think the average for a dialysis patient is 8 days they could live without getting a dialysis treatment.
Wow.
You know, just being able to hook a patient up to a machine, like, especially if they're in a state where they are literally, you know, dying, or, you know, their bodies are filled up with toxins because their kidneys are not working. Bodies are literally, you know, filling up with poison. So dialysis goes in and just removes a lot of that. So just being able to watch someone going from a state where, hey, they can't breathe, they're, you know, they're feeling really lethargic, or they might even be in a coma, and doing a few dialysis treatments really turned them around. We saw that a lot early in COVID, because, you know, a lot of, you know, especially in the early stages of COVID, where they go into kidney failure suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, actually, them getting their dialysis treatments really made a huge difference. And we actually were able, people that were literally, we never thought would survive, ended up walking out of the hospital several weeks later, which was great to see. And yeah. we would, especially early in the stages of COVID, we would kind of give people a parade almost every time they left the hospital, because, hey, we didn't really know what we were dealing with. And
oh, yeah,
when someone did survive.
So do you get pretty attached to some of your patients and get to know them pretty well and get involved with their lives at all? Or are they just like...
Well, I definitely do get attached, especially some patients more than others, because they just, you know, your personalities just, you know, combine well. So yeah, especially when I was working in the dialysis clinics and you see the same patients, you know, on a regular basis, you definitely get attached and get to know a lot about their personal lives. I tried to keep a professional distance as much as I could, because like you said, hey, you never know what could happen. And you do need to keep some type of professional boundary. So I try not to get, I would say, overly attached. I wouldn't say I was always successful with that.
Was there a lot more challenges to being a traveling nurse than just being a stationary one?
There's some things that are easier. For example, you don't get caught up as much of the drama, which I really like. You know, I like to come to work, do my job, take care of the patients, and not have to deal with a lot of the drama that comes with it. Because, hey, there is a lot of drama and anytime you work with a lot of people. But it can be more challenging because, hey, you know, you're picking up and moving every few months. You know, when you start getting used to a place, you have to learn a new area, a new place very quickly, and you have to be able to adapt very quickly.
Yeah. And you're still doing this, right? You're still doing this now?
I'm not doing so much of the traveling state to state anymore, but I do do what's called like I do float a lot. So that means within my local area in Colorado, I go to a lot of different hospitals.
Well, sounds like you're not going to get bored anyway.
No. So
what made you decide to get into nursing to begin with?
I just wanted to get into healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I figured nursing was a good option just because you're not, you know, versus a doctor, you're dealing with a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of insurance companies, a lot of stuff like that. And then nursing is just a lot more focused on bedside care, even though there is a lot of paperwork involved. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like it was just more, you could be more patient focused rather than dealing with a lot of other issues that you don't want to.
Sure.
Yeah.
in addition to this nursing book, you've written some others. Mm-hmm. And one I want to discuss is this, it's called I Love Your Food.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I got that book and read it to my grandkids and they loved it.
Oh, so, well, yeah, well, I very much appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Uh-huh. I like how, okay, let's discuss this book a little bit. The subject is bullying. Mm-hmm. And it focuses on one primary bully at a school and all the different aspects surrounding it. And even you get a lot of aspects of the bullies from his perspective as well. And the victims, the parents, the school and everything. Give us an idea of this story. You know, what it's the central facets of it and what's it about?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you mentioned, a lot of it's about bullying. And yeah, you know, the story follows, you know, a lot of different kids and how they interact with one particular bully at a school. And he's kind of, you know, obviously he torments people, especially people smaller than him, which pretty much everyone at the school is.
Right.
And, you know, he just picks on everyone and is just ruthless. However, one of the central themes throughout the book is people coming together for the love of the same food.
Yes. Yeah.
And then there's a kid who moved into the small town where the school is from a foreign country. You know, his dad gets a job there, basically.
Bashir?
And, yeah, Bashir is the character's name. And he's a really nice, pleasant kid. But he starts to kind of get bullied by this vicious bully. But Bashir sees something different in him. Like, he mm-hmm. kind of notices, wait a minute, like, why is this kid acting this way? There's got to be a reason. And he mm-hmm. looks, there's this one moment where, like, Bashir, like, his mom always made him, like, this really tasty Middle Eastern food that he would, that everybody, that all of his friends even love. And he always had that. And he sees his bully just kind of, the bully's kind of sitting by his lonesome in the corner. And he kind of sees that he just has, like, crackers and juice or something, mm-hmm. something really, you know, menial for lunch. And he kind of looks like, wow, that's his lunch. Like, that's all he has to eat. So he kind of figures, well, there's something more going on underneath. He's not just mean-spirited for no reason. Mm-hmm. And this results in him being kind, overly kind to the person, and even sharing the food that's native to his country. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Bashir is from Jordan. Mm-hmm. So a lot of Middle Eastern food, you know, falafel, things like that. He actually shares it with the rest of the kids in the school, including the bully. And he is overly kind to him just to show him that, hey, you know, he doesn't hate him. He wants to be his friend. And this starts to change the bully's mindset. And then, not to give the end of the story away, but we slowly learn, like, why Brad, the bully is his name, is acting that way, and why he treats others the way he does. And there's more to it than meets the eye, so to speak. So, but the central premise is, hey, people coming together for the love of the same food. I'm a foodie. My wife's a foodie. Mm-hmm. So, hey, I love being able to incorporate that into a children's book. And I'm planning on making it like a long series. So several books under the I Love Your Food series.
Will it all be about bullying, or are there different subjects?
Right now, yeah. The second book I wrote is also about, you know, a bully. Yeah.
We'll be looking forward to that series of books then.
How old are your grandkids, if you don't mind me asking?
8 and 5.
Oh, good. I'm glad that they were able to read. You were able to read the book to them and they enjoyed it. I'm really happy to hear that.
Right. Yeah, they did. They liked it all the way through. They kind of almost felt sorry for Brad, the bully, in the end there. But I guess, yeah, that's part of the idea. You know, bullies are, you know, we can just condemn them or we can try to correct the situation, too. So
right.
I like how you did that in the book, especially with the food and the friendship with the kids. It really worked well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, there's another book you wrote called I Love You, Apu.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a story behind this book. What motivated you to write it? Could you tell us that story?
Sure, absolutely. So everyone, obviously the show The Simpsons, mm-hmm. I know it's not as popular anymore, but it was really big in the 90s and early 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, probably in its prime, probably the most popular show in history, at least the most popular animated TV show in history. And there's a Indian American character named Apu. He is the Quickie Mart owner. From what I've heard, he's not really on the show anymore. At most, he might be like a background character now, which kind of sucks because I thought personally he was a great character. But nonetheless, he was the owner of the Quickie Mart. He was a pretty, well-known character during the show's prime. He does talk with a goofy Indian accent, of course. And he is stereotyped in a lot of ways. What happened was back, I can't remember the exact year, but it's been about probably 5-6 years by now. There's an Indian American comedian who actually called out the character and, said that he's a racist and sensitive stereotype towards Indian people. And when I heard what he said, I disagreed with him. So I kind of wanted to reach out to him, but I couldn't get a hold of him. So what I did was I said, okay, well, I want to get my point across. I'll use my platform, which is writing. So I wrote that book, I Love You, Apu, to kind of counter what this particular Indian American comedian said, which he made a documentary. I think it's called The Problem with Apu, The Problem with Apu. But it's a short documentary, 45 minutes. If you guys haven't seen it, definitely watch it. I thought it was a well done documentary, and he does make some good points, and it was well done. I just disagreed with a lot of his premise and what he said. So I wrote that book, I Love You, Apu, to counter what he said in the book. And my point was, Apu is a goofy character. He has like that stereotypical Indian accent and all of that. And he has a lot of other, quirks that, people can pick up on that people might associate with a traditional Indian person. But, obviously accentuated excessively for comedic effect. However, throughout the series, as they delve in more into the character and dissect it, you actually learn a lot more about Apu. For example, he was highly educated from one of, if not the top, engineering universities in India. He came here as an immigrant to further his studies and get a PhD. He achieved that, and then he didn't want to leave with debt, so he got a job at the Quickie Mart. He became an owner of a Quickie Mart, started a business on his own. Ultimately throughout the series, we learned he's a good friend, he's a good father, a family man, kind of a ladies man as well at one point. And he's really one of the most beloved characters in the entire city of Springfield. So in my estimation, he was actually a very positive representation of Indian people. If you look beyond just that goofy accent and everything, he's actually...
You acknowledge there are stereotypes, but that's good, I think, to have a discussion all the way around, because it's like a never-ending debate on humor, how far you should go, what offends some people, should you not say anything, should you say too much, So I like to see that, how you open it up and say, hey, wait a minute, you're Indian heritage, like Apu, and you were not offended.
And I don't have a problem necessarily with people who were. It's like, hey,
sure.
You made your point. And a lot of people did. I think a good amount of people did agree with what he said. But hey, there's a lot of people, including other Indians, who disagreed and agreed with more of what I said. So I just want the discussion open. I don't want to, discredit anyone's feelings.
Now, I got to know, did the guy who wrote the documentary, did you ever hear back from him?
No. And actually, going back to the book, we're actually taking it a little further because a friend of mine who has a small streaming service, we're actually working on a documentary together related to my book. So it's going to be kind of a, I don't know if I want to call it a counter documentary because, hey, we're going to welcome viewpoints of all backgrounds, but, I'm going to make my point and then other people can make theirs.
That's good. That's good to have that open discussion. Let's hear about, you got a couple other books that sound interesting. One is called Grandpa's Knife.
Yes, that's the book I'm currently working on. So Grandpa's Knife, it's about a boy who kind of sees his grandpa just as this old man who can't take care of himself and doesn't really think much of him anymore. However, at one point he is gifted a knife from his grandpa, a knife that he has had for decades. And every time the young boy holds the knife, he actually gets transported back to back in time and actually lives the experiences of his grandpa, you know, and a lot of these experiences, some are joyous, some are very violent and sad and devastating. And then he learns a lot more about his grandpa through those experiences and realizes, hey, he's not just like this he's not always just been like this 90-year-old man who can't take care of himself right now. He's actually had a very, very interesting life. He's actually kind of a badass. I don't know if I can say that word on here, but but he learns a lot and develops a high level of respect for his grandpa because of that. One of the things that inspired me to write this book was this isn't my grandpa story, but what inspired me to write it is my mom has this heirloom. It's my grandpa's old knife, like a large knife that he always carried around with him when he was a police officer in India. And I didn't appreciate it much as a kid, but as an adult, I definitely do appreciate it more now. And I just looked at it and I was like, man, I wonder what this knife has been through. Like, I don't know. Has it ever killed anybody? What has it done? You know? And so I just kind of said, hey, let's think about like where a knife has been, you know, especially for someone who's lived some of the stories my grandpa might have lived. But again, you know, this story is not in no way, you know, my grandpa's story. It was just inspired by that knife.
Yeah. So whenever he grasps the knife, he feels these experiences that his grandfather felt.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So that's Grandpa's Knife. And there's one other book we'd like to discuss here a little bit. What is this next one?
So it's called a Desi Pilgrimage, D-E-S-I. And Desi is basically a term used for Indian people. And basically it follows the story of an Indian family immigrating to the U.S. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's my story, but there are elements of my family story incorporated into it. So it's kind of a fun book. It was actually my first full novel that I wrote. It kind of at the beginning, the main character is kind of the parents and then maybe the younger brother, and they have their own experiences. You know, they even at one point I talk about, hey, what the family experienced after 9/11 with a lot of the racism and stereotyping that occurred for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know,
people didn't differentiate between Middle Eastern or Indian, Sikh. Yeah.
And it's a shame that they, you know, were going after people in general for no reason. Yeah, and just, exactly. But, you know, a lot of people just got lumped into one category. And it's so unfortunate a lot of innocent people got hurt because of, you know, people's ignorance.
And you cover that in the book?
A little bit. Yeah.
So, Ankit, is there any specific effect you want your books to have on your readers? Do you have any certain goal, any motivation for writing?
It depends on the book that they're reading, but really I want them to, you know, not be able to put the book down and say, hey, you know, I was so enthralled in your story or what you were writing about that, you know, whether I agreed with what you said or not, you know, I really wanted to keep reading and see what else you had to say. And, you know, there's people talk about books that were written decades ago or centuries ago and that they still hold a lot of value today. And I hope that my books do the same thing for a lot of people, whether a lot of people read them or not, or just a few people. If, you know, just like you said, hey, you told me that your grandsons read my children's book and they got a lot of joy out of them, which, hey, that's, you know, motivation enough for me to keep writing.
Right. Now, you've got a website. Now, if people want to get some of your books or find out more about you, how can they find you on the internet?
Sure. So if you go to my website, ankitshukla.org, that's ankitshukla.org, you can, you can contact me through there. That has access to my social media and email. So definitely reach out to me directly from there.
Ankitshukla.org. We'll also put that on our Facebook page for you. Okay, Ankit, it's been great having you here with us. Good luck in your writing career and your motivational speaking and your nursing and whatever else you get involved with.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
And that is our program for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed our storytellers this week, Barbara Legere and Ankit Shukla. And don't you dare move, because Michael Woodson and Michael Carson are up next with Living Art. Make 90.1 FM a part of your everyday life. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. This past September, the remains of Typhoon Murbach wreaked havoc on Alaska's west coast. The region is no stranger to big storms, but the waters in the northern Pacific were unusually warm this year, so Murbach formed much closer to Alaska than most typhoons do. Rick Toman is with the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says by the time the storm slowed down over colder water, it was relatively close to shore, and damage from the wind was severe.
All that wind basically acts as a plow, pushing the water north. And so in many communities, we saw water levels at or near the highest of record.
If Murbach had hit later in the year, sea ice could have helped dampen the waves before they reached shore, and frozen ground would have helped prevent erosion. But the storm hit early.
So no sea ice, no frozen ground to even offer a modicum of protection against the wind and waves.
The storm caused massive erosion and flooding, and global warming makes it more likely it will happen again, bringing yet another threat to a place that already has one of the harshest climates in the world. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Hi, this is Purell, and I support KPFT Radio because I love listening to the blues programming, the rock programming, the deadbeat program is my favorite. Just saying. So please join me in supporting KPFT Community Radio, radio that you cannot get on any other type of commercial station. Please call to donate at 713-526-5738 or donate on kpft.org.
On Thursday, April 13th from 6 to 10 p.m., art car lovers can get a sneak peek of this year's mobile masterpieces at the Art Car Sneak Peek at Discovery Green. This free and family-friendly event in downtown Houston features live music, art activities for kids, food and drinks, and the opportunity to interact with 100-plus art cars and meet the art car artists. So grab a friend or a loved one and head to Discovery Green on April 13th. For more information, visit www.thehoustonartcarparade.com.
KPFT is supported in part by Imprint, quien presentará Rodrigo Fuentes, uno de los autores más reconocidos en la nueva generación de literatura guatemalteca, para una lectura y recepción el viernes 14 de abril a las 7:30 p.m. en la Casa de Imprint. Para más información, visita imprint.org.
Coming up on the next This Way Out.
You just woke up on the 24th of February hearing those sounds of heavy bombing in the center of the Ukraine, in the capital. I never thought I will experience such events in my entire life. LGBTQI people are so visible not only on the front line in the army, but also volunteering, doing all those heavy work to support everybody in Ukraine. Russians seeing open LGBTQI people as a threat to their regime.
All that and more this week when you discover This Way Out.
Fascist, Saturdays at 11 p.m. here on Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT.